Welcome to The Sacramentalists, a podcast where the ancient Christian faith is brought to bear on issues prevalent in modern culture. We're your hosts. I'm Father Hayden Butler.
And I'm Father Wesley Walker.
And sadly, we're without our dear companion, Father Creighton, today, but we wish him well. And we are joined here with a new friend to the podcast, Dr. Brian Ballard.
Brian, how's it going? Great to be here with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're excited to get to talk to you today. For our listeners, Brian, would you mind could you just introduce yourself a little bit? What work you're doing in philosophy and where you're teaching and what are some of the highlights in the recent season for you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a parishioner at Hayden's Church, St. Matthew's, which is a place I love. And I'm also a professor of philosophy at Concordia in Irvine. I'm working on a book right now called God, World, and Value. And it's sort of about the idea that Christianity, if true, would enchant the world for us, especially the way we engage with nature. So if you're a Christian and you have the sense of like, you know, one of the ways I connect with God is by hiking or sitting at the beach or in watching the birds or something to that effect, then I'm trying to think about what exactly is this sense that we have that our Christianity is shaping how we encounter the natural world. I'm trying to think that through. I'm also really interested in human rights and different explanations for human rights. And I'm convinced that the best explanations for human rights are going to ultimately appeal to some kind of theism, in particular Christianity, and that the secular project of trying to explain human rights is not going to work out in the end. So those are some of the projects I'm up to in my professional life. When I have time away from my wonderful children and wife, those are the things that I am working on.
That's wonderful. I appreciate the introduction to that. So, you know, in order to get to know you a little bit better here today, how did you come about, pursuing this line of philosophy, particularly enchantment, is one that I think when people consider philosophy and what philosophers do, I don't know that that's the first topic that comes to mind. So, can you, what was your early research in? What was your doctoral research in? And then how did you come about this line of inquiry?
Yeah, philosophers maybe tend to be up to the business of disenchantment more often than...
Didn't want to say it.
Yeah, but, you know, hey, it's okay. We'll start by telling the truth. I converted to Christianity when I was a teenager, and pretty quickly I was reading C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, and there was this sense that for them, Christianity was this thing that lit up the world. And I'm particularly thinking of Lewis's sermon, like the Weight of Glory, or chapter 4 of Orthodoxy, The Ethics of Elfland, the stream flows downhill because it is bewitched, that kind of thing. And I've always been haunted by the sense of the enchantment of the world that's sort of alive in the pages of those writers. And I got interested in philosophy really as an evangelist and apologist at heart, which is sort of like, I try to keep that a secret in my field, but deep down, I'm someone whose life has been transformed by the gospel, and I want to be able to share that with people and remove intellectual obstacles for them to have a meaningful encounter and make a faith commitment. So on a personal level, philosophy was always part of my sort of expression of my faith. And then there's more and more work these days about the nature of emotions, the ways that emotions connect us with value or fail to connect us with value. There's more work in analytic philosophy on meaning in life. That used to be considered a meaningless question. What's the meaning of life? And now it's taken very seriously over the last 20 years. I think these are all very good things. There's a lot of, in the philosophy of religion, in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of focus on religious language. How can we actually refer to God? Is it even possible? And then the 80s and 90s, a lot of focus on metaphysics and epistemology. How do we know God exists? Do we need some kind of argument, or would an experience of God be enough? And I'd say in the last 20 years, we've seen what you might call a sort of practical turn, or maybe an evaluative turn, where there's a focus now on the lived experience of faith, trying to describe what is it like to actually inhabit us, life within a certain religion. And there's a lot more interest on the practical upshots of different religions, the ways that God's existence would or wouldn't equip us to flourish or make life more meaningful. Or so I would say my focus on enchantment fits within that shift in the analytic philosophy of religion over the last 20 years, if that maybe helps frame some of that.
No, it definitely does. And I think you're in the presence here of a couple of kindred spirits on a number of those points. Father Wes and I particularly are huge fans of Hugh of St. Victor and this idea of reading the creation and the legibility of creation and how mm-hmm. we really, I think it contributes to significantly to that idea of like what sometimes I think called the theological imagination, right? Of you know, there's the kind of the things we say about it, but then there's the way we envision those truths kind of coming together and working with each other and cohabitating with each other, mm-hmm. and how we think it's all put together.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think I like that.
And just to piggyback on that, I think at the kind of intersection of all these lines of inquiry is the idea that we are supposed to become more human. I think that's Hugh's vision. And I think that's very much C.S. Lewis's vision. And it sounds like that's the kind of work you're doing, which is really exciting. Because I think that idea of flourishing and human rights, I think, are all very connected and important.
No, that's right.
Yes, I quite agree.
So talk us through, Brian, if you would, because you used a term there, and I want to make sure that we're all on the same page with it, because I think it would be helpful. And having read some of your work, I found it helpful how you draw it out. Can you explain to everybody kind of what valuation is and in the way that you're using it here? Because it seems like a really useful way category of thought. And so could you walk us through some of the introductory concepts of that?
Yeah, so just like real basic. When I say value, when philosophers talk about value, they're talking about things being good. Some things are good and some things are bad. Let's start with a basic observation about life. And I'm just taking for granted that some things are objectively good and some things are objectively bad, that being tortured to death slowly for no good reason is objectively bad. Some people, I'm sure, think there's a very interesting conversation to be had about whether that's objectively true. I'm not one of those people. And so I'm just taking for granted some things are objectively good, some things are objectively bad, and that and then we have a set of attitudes. We're equipped with capacities for responding to value. And one of those responses is we can know that things are good, for example, by reflecting on what it would be to torture someone for your amusement and just seeing that, well, that seems bad. It's something I think we know is bad. But knowing something as bad or good is not the only way that we can respond to value. We can also respond with our emotions. Knowing that you have lost someone dear to you is one thing, but actually grieving that and experiencing that loss sort of like in the dark soils of your heart, that's a different thing, and in many ways a fuller and deeper response to value. You can also respond to value through actions. I think rituals are a communal way of responding to value, of responding to the good or to the bad. A funeral is a way of, I guess that's a mix there. You're responding to the bad of having lost this person, responding to the good that was their life and your love for them in your life. The Eucharist, I think, is at least on some level a way of, for us to collectively respond to the good that is Christ's sacrifice. So I'm thinking value is out there in the world, and then we have these attitudes that connect us with value, that are ways for us to respond to value. And one of the, you know, I think purposes of human life is for us to respond in the deepest way we can to value. So maybe that's helpful as setup. And then I'm interested in the paper you read, Hayden. I'm interested in a particular kind of value. Maybe we can get into that, or I don't know where you want to head after this.
I do want to head into that. I think a clarifying question that just from my own edification would be, okay, so like how would you, you know, account for then kind of the different, you know, values people would place on something, even that we might call something that's objectively good, objectively bad. You mentioned the kind of case where someone could have a very interesting conversation about the relative goodness of being, you know, slowly tortured for no reason. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, there are some other cases where it seems like valuation varies, you know, significantly. Mm-hmm. How would you account for that?
Yeah, it's certainly true that some people are into some freaky stuff. So, I would say there's a couple of totally innocuous things in the vicinity. One is just that life contains a long list of things that are objectively good, and none of us can respond to all of them. It's like you might be really into jazz music. I'm not. I probably could get into it, but I just don't have the time and the energy. So all of us in our lives specialize in a subset of the values at the buffet, so to speak. And I mean, your plate's only so big, but there's a lot of food at the buffet. Let's put it like that. So, I spend a lot of time reading poetry, as I know you do, Hayden, and that's one of the values I specialize in. I don't think you have to read poetry, but it's certainly one of the things that can be part of the good life. And one of the ways that we can be, I think, insufficiently imaginative when we think about what is a good life like, is we think the values we've specialized in are things everyone has to specialize in, or we fail to imagine how the things they've specialized in are things that are worthwhile. But that being said, that's not to say, oh, values are subjective or relative. That's just to say all of us take a bite of a different piece of the pie and realize different values in our lives from that menu. Now, that being said, that's not the entirety of the variation that we see in terms of what people value. Some people have genuine conflicts of value. If you tell me that abortion is permissible at 39 weeks, and I tell you it's not permissible, we have a definite disagreement in value. If you tell me that an acceptable way of grieving is to go into the forest and murder a stranger, as they do in the Ilongot tribe, so I'm told, then we probably have a disagreement about value there. And if you tell me that, the sound of orphans weeping in the night is more beautiful than the Moonlight Sonata, we probably also have a disagreement of value. And so I don't take that to be us specializing in different values, but actually having a conflict in visions over the good itself. So how do we explain that? Well, this might sound pigheaded, but if it's genuinely a conflict, it just means at least one person has to be wrong. That's just what logic requires. So I don't see that as fundamentally different than someone who tells me that the earth rests on the back of a turtle, which rests on the back of a turtle, and so on. They're right or they're wrong. There's a fact of the matter. It's a further question, who has better evidence on their side? Who has the best reasons for their judgment? They could both have good reasons. People can have reasons for thinking things that are false. I illustrate this to my class by telling them it's my birthday. I let them sing to me, and then I tell them it's not my birthday. But I take it I gave them, I tricked them, you see. But I take it I gave them good testimonial evidence to take me to believe it's my birthday. So they had a false but totally reasonable judgment. So, I mean, it could be that people who disagree about value, sometimes they're both believing on the basis of the reasons they have, but one of them has to be mistaken. And I think it's often as simple as that. We don't, I mean, generally, we're open to the idea that some people are wrong about things. When I'm told there was a time at least when the government of Iran denied the Holocaust occurred, we don't think, well, who's to say? Tomato, tomato. It didn't occur for them, but it occurred for us. There's no interesting sense in which that could be true. So I think that moral disagreements and even aesthetic disagreements, even disagreements over matters of taste, are much like that. If someone prefers the taste of human excrement to the taste of a fresh loaf of bread, I think there's something fundamentally deficient or mistaken about their taste. So I'd be willing to be an objectivist even at that level. And I have yet to hear a reason for being a relativist about those matters of taste that wouldn't just as well commit you to being a relativist about obvious features of morality, like you shouldn't torture someone just for your amusement. So that's a little flavor of how I would handle this worry that many people have about disagreement. I don't think that gets to the deepest level of it, and we can talk about what I think that worry is actually about, if you want to, but that's just philosophically, that would be my response. And then I would want to say, here's what I think you're really worried about. If you're worried about, oh, there's all this disagreement about morality and aesthetics and who's to say, if that's really your worry, I haven't really spoken to what it is at the root, but I think that philosophical response is basically the argument I would make.
No, I think there's a lot there. Particularly, I'm intrigued by, usually, we can find, I think, and especially in Christian conversations about it, assertions of the objectivity of morality, of truth. But then also, it seems like you're suggesting, that there's an objectivity when it comes to beauty as well. I think I would agree with that. But I also think it's one of those ones that, like, okay, we'll give you goodness and truth, but beauty has to remain subjective here. And I think to draw that back to that question of, evaluation, right? And coming back towards, your main question of enchantment here. I think, again, the way that I, sometimes even Christians within Christian conversations about this, the way that we can imagine the world put together, and these different, objective goodnesses, these objective good principles or objectively true principles, working together, can sometimes produce even, wildly different kind of, fields of imagination in which these things are working together. And so, like, an example of that would be, you said earlier, right, this idea of enchantment, and being able to find, like, an objectively, beautiful thing or a good thing in like the Moonlight Sonata, right? Something objectively beautiful, right? Something that there's beauty present in this thing. I think that there's a kind of Christian imagination that imagines the world to be put together in such a way that really there is one very, narrow slice of good things, and the rest is just completely, bankrupt of goodness, mm-hmm. truth, or beauty. It almost sounds like from your description. And I think, if we, like again, when I think of Hugh of St. Victor and people like him, you almost would reverse the ratio to where it's like, okay, there's a lot of really good and true and beautiful, things to know. You use the image of this huge buffet of good things to appreciate. And we may be taking different things from that buffet and going back to that, part of the conversation. How do you kind of navigate when you within Christian conversations, you have, on what seem like complete opposite visions of the world, where one would say there's actually nothing good out there except for a very few things that we need mm-hmm. to latch onto, otherwise we're doomed. And versus the other one that maybe has an uncritically, positive vision of everything, like really everything's good. And we mm-hmm. do that. You're suggesting something in between. So how do you kind of navigate those two, opposites on either side?
Yeah, what a nice way to frame that. Yes, I do often like to remind my Calvinist friends that it was originally very good before it went wrong. Sometimes they forget that piece of it. But yeah, I take it you don't just mean my Calvinist friends. Some of them are into this kind of re-enchantment project too.
A real movement there, I think, mm-hmm. among like our Reformed friends about that.
Yeah, yeah. But maybe that really is the answer to your question is boy. Well, first of all, sometimes people do hear me speak and they say, it seems like you don't sufficiently take into account the evils in the world and this like vision that you,
right.
So fair enough. We definitely want to take those things into account. I've read the Holocaust memoirs too. So I'm not just sort of glib over here. The same buffet of goods is also a buffet of evils. And most of us specialize, this is going to sound wrong, specialize in certain evils, by which I mean some evils animate us in a way that others don't. And that might be okay. So if you're, Nelson Mandela had a project in his life to eradicate a certain evil. He wasn't eradicating factory farming. That wasn't the evil. That's okay. Who would fault him for that? Because none of us can be animated by all of the evils. We choose some evils. I would say most of us choose some evils and specialize in sort of, to the extent that we do good in the world, undoing those evils rather than others. But more generally, the middle way I would say is charted by the original goodness of creation, and that creation being a thing that is in ruins and has departed from that original goodness. So I guess to me that would be the key that this is we live in a great palace, but it's a ruined palace, and it's been marked for restoration just as we have been. And so you wouldn't, if you think it's just a heap of dung, you've missed the fact that it is a palace. And if you think it's a palace, you've missed the fact that it's a ruin. So it's a ruined palace. And I don't know, by the way, whether we should think that creation was ever really complete. There's this, some of the church fathers, you have this vision of creation being sort of unfinished. Adam and Eve are immature, rather than, oh, they were completely developed and then they fell from that state. Rather,
right. There's like a probative state that they are, that we see them in Genesis 1 and 2.
Well, to go back to Hugh St. Victor, he believed sin slides us into non-being, that Adam and Eve were created as being, but that what we're all called to is something beyond that, what he calls beautiful being, which brings in this sort of aesthetic dimension that is so, key to understanding. Yeah.
Oh, what's the text there?
That is, I think it runs kind of throughout, but he talks about that in his De Sacramentis sort of at the beginning as he goes through anthropology. Yeah. So there are these kind of three categories and beautiful being.
I'll have to check that out. That sounds like, that's sort of a, of course, Neoplatonist idea that evil is a sort of deficit of being in some sense. But yeah, I get the idea of being called beyond the ordinary being into a more of a fullness of being, whatever that comes to. I like what that's pointing to, at least.
Actually, kind of related to that, I had a question based on where we've been so far, which because I very much agree with you. I think the idea of the ruined palace is really helpful and key. I think it prevents problematic tendencies on both sides of our engagement. But there is an interesting question about how to actually apply some of this disagreement. So when we're talking with someone with whom we do have a real disagreement with overvaluation, what are, maybe in your experience, what have been some good ways to deploy this understanding? So I'm thinking of like Augustine, who will say, well, you're still looking for something good, even if you're misusing it, you know, that there's still some good in it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Right. I don't know what you, your thoughts on
that. Right. Right. Yeah. You want to have this extramarital affair. Well, what's the desire behind the desire? The desire behind the desire is for a life of adventure, to feel young again, to connect with beauty that's so immense it feels like it tears a rift between heaven and earth. So there's an experience of female beauty that can be like that. So what is the desire behind the desire? And then we find that, and then we see that the extramarital affair is not the thing that's going to give you that thing you really want at the bottom of your heart. And I really like that way of approaching sin, because it dignifies the sinner. It looks for the spark of light within their broken hearts, and it acknowledges the pain that is there, but also directs them to the better path, to the extent that it's our place to do so. You know, I'm generally not in the habit of directing people, but you know, I just got to start with the man in the mirror. But you folks have that responsibility. So I don't know. Is that a kind of what you're getting at? Is that the technique you guys use? How would you put that?
No, I think you're really onto something there, and it almost seems like there's kind of a microcosm of that ruined palace image, but for the human heart, right? That there's this, right? There is this something that strives and grasps, right? We just got done in one of our Bible studies, you know, in Acts 17 with Paul at the Areopagus, right? And saying that like this era of where we've been searching and grasping, right, and putting up an idol to the unknown God, right, and yearning for something. And finding that, even in someone that has a referent for the thing they're yearning for, there can still be yearnings that they try to requite in really unhelpful and self-destructive ways, and that are inimical to that end of attaining to life with the one that can really satisfy the longing of the human heart. That's really helpful.
Yeah. Pascal said, basically that you'll never understand human beings unless you understand that they're kings in exile.
I find that to be very helpful and very applicable pastorally. I think that's a fantastic way of describing it.
Yeah, I like that you said that the human heart is itself the ruined palace. I collect, one of the things I collect is metaphors for the human psyche. And that's a great one. I love, it's interesting to line them all up. You know, St. Teresa has this metaphor that of the interior castle that you journey within to see the light of God's old mystical notion. Plato's idea of that the soul is a sort of city. And then, but what you're suggesting is like the Christianization of that Platonic vision that the soul is still a microcosm of the cosmos, but the soul is ruined as the cosmos is ruined. So it's a microcosm maybe for a different reason.
So to circle back to an initial comment you made about enchantment, you if I want to make sure I understand it correctly, which is you said that if the fact that God made the thing should have a bearing on our valuation of it, and if we would assent to God as the maker of something, we would have a, I would assume, a higher valuation of the thing. Can you unpack some of what you meant in that comment?
So here's an analogy. Suppose that you have this old sketch hanging on your wall, and your art historian friend comes over and asks you, hey, who made that sketch? It's really cool. And you don't know. It's just been in your family for decades, and she's mesmerized by it. So she begs you, and you let her take it home, and she does whatever art historians do. I don't, do they have labs? I don't know. What do these people do? And she finds out somehow definitively that this is a page from Leonardo's notebooks. The question is, how would that change the value you place on that object? I presume the value you place on it would soar, and you're not just seeing dollar signs to be made at auctions. Even if you were a billionaire, you could see that this sketch being made by Leonardo would add something profound to it, would give you a new way of appreciating the sketch. I would prefer my sketch to be made by Leonardo rather than made by some anonymous hack or produced by an AI, but that's not our topic today, is it? That teaches us that sometimes an artifact becomes more valuable just because it's made by an illustrious creator. And an analogous phenomenon is when you keep the dreadful art of your children, not because it is great, but because they made it, in that case, not illustrious creators, but beloved and cherished creators. So sometimes the one who makes it has a status, sometimes a status in relation to us that gives us a deeper way of appreciating what they've created. And so, if you hold that thought steady, you can see that, wait a minute, think about how theists understand the world. They think God made all of this, the Grand Canyon, the birds and the bees, you and me. And so that would mean, by analogy, that all of this would become much more valuable. We'd have a new way of appreciating certainly the natural order, to lift a stone from the earth and say, here is something made by God. I hold it in my hand now. And then you realize, wait a minute. Creating something is not the only way that an illustrious person can add value to their artifacts. There's just a lot of different ways for artifacts to sort of leech value off of the people connected to them. So think about how many of us would like to have a desk owned by C.S. Lewis, where he wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, in our private office. Wouldn't that be nice? Think about the pen that signed the Emancipation Proclamation. That pen is totally ordinary, but it's a sacred relic because of what was done with it in terms of moral triumphs. So being used for noble purposes, as in the case of the pen, being owned by illustrious persons, as in the case of the desk, these are also ways for artifacts to become profoundly valuable in ways that they weren't before. The pen was just an ordinary pen, and now it's a museum relic because of Lincoln's the way Lincoln used it. All of those relations hold between God and the world. I mean, in a perfectly straightforward sense, God owns the world. To date, I have not been able to find an account of the basis of God's ownership, his property rights, but it seems like there's something like maker's rights. And the Psalms even tell you that. It's like the earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof, because he has laid the foundations of the earth. So the Bible itself, which endorses this ownership, seems to also give you the basis of the ownership, which is something like his having made it, which seems just totally plausible anyways. And God, of course, uses creation to noble ends. I mean, what we could have a very interesting conversation about why God would create in the first place, but whatever it is, it's going to be something good, and we are aware of at least some of his purposes, such as his redemptive purposes. This whole creation is the stage on which God is telling his great story of the triumph of good over evil. So that presents a project to ask, what are all of the ways that God stands in relation to the world that would exalt or elevate the world, that would give us new ways of appreciating or encountering its goodness? And that's the central aim of my book, is to untangle all of those, what I call worth-bestowing relations. And I have, at this point, I have a 13 of them, but we don't need to talk about all 13. You get the point is just to get the basic idea.
No, that's really helpful in clarifying that concept. It brings to mind a kind of a practical question that I discussed once with a mentor, and this maybe as a way of putting it into a little bit of an application too for our listeners, is it seems like sometimes there's a kind of mismatch between maybe the value of a thing, and because of it, the relations that have bestowed value to it, and then the place or context in which that thing is either held or possessed or acquired or for the purpose for which it. And the example that comes to mind, a mentor once posed this question of, would it be wrong to put the David, the statue, right, in your backyard? Like to take it away from where it's on display and put it in your backyard. And then we just kind of knock that around. Using that as a kind of, tongue-in-cheek example, but I think like one that illustrates a real point. How would you kind of combine those concepts together and say, when there's that disproportionate thing of like this is an immensely maybe valuable art, work of art, and my backyard is not really a worthy place to display it, or even like fitting, maybe even like put it in a living room. Someone's like, suburban, South
Or a
Orange County
storage
living room,
box.
right? Yeah. Putting it in like in a storage container, right? So
Or
could you
destroying
help?
it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, this actually appears as a this appears in scripture quite a lot. When especially like we've been thinking about that during Lent. The epistle lessons are often like this thing that you're doing, this practice that is among you, is of the wrong kind of value given what you now are and have become. And that seems to your concepts here, your framework here seems to obtain on that question. So could you maybe like unpack why that would be wrong to for me to display the David in my backyard?
Yeah, so that example actually points to something much discussed in theories of property rights, which is there seem to be some objects. So property rights, ownership could be understood as like a bundle of rights to dispose of a certain object how you will. Right? It's like if I own it, it means I can do what I want with it. And you don't get to tell me, you could make suggestions, but ultimately it's up to me what I do with it. But it's interesting because public artifacts of interest to all of us, like the Mona Lisa, seem like things where actually, even if you bought it, there are some things that you simply must not do with it. You don't have the right to destroy it. You can't buy the Mona Lisa and set it on fire in your backyard. That would be morally unacceptable. You wouldn't have the right to, you wouldn't be within your rights. Isn't that interesting? I have that intuition really, really vividly. And it's something about the public's interest in that object. Not everything is for sale, or the extent, it's really the extent to which you could own it is limited. I mean, there are ways you can own it. So like, it might be something where, as its value appreciates, maybe I'm able to make money off of it when it's sold from this museum to some other museum. Maybe I could have an ownership right in that sense, but I certainly can't just dispose of it in any old way that I wish. So, I mean, that is truly an interesting phenomenon. But you asked something else about, refresh me on the ending of that
So
question about.
it would be the opposite relationship, right? And that one, the David is too valuable for me to put into my backyard and just, sort of privately enjoy it like that. That would be an unacceptable thing to do with the David, right? Then I would think about the opposite relationship where, let's say, there's something that maybe has a sort of value that's unworthy of even of me being like a possessor of it or to acquire it or something like that, right? Like I ought not own this thing. I ought not
Oh, yes.
utilize this thing or
Right.
practice or artifact, whatever.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So there's the inversion of this phenomenon I call bestowed worth, where by association with some great person or event, the artifact gets this special value. There's an inversion that I call tarnishing, where an object becomes tarnished by its association with bad persons and the bad things they do. I mean, think about a knife used in a string of grisly murders is not one you would chop tomatoes with, and someone who did that and then served you up a salad, you'd be sort of disturbed to find out that this was a murder weapon that they got from police evidence or something, right? They'd be guilty of something more than a prank, I think. Another example would be, this is sort of a gruesome example. In Elie Wiesel's Holocaust memoir, he describes a camp dentist who rips the teeth out of inmates' mouth to take the gold fillings and then sell the gold. And so imagine you find a beautiful piece of jewelry at a pawn shop and you find out that it's gold collected by that camp dentist and melted down and fashioned into a ring. Would you be willing to wear that ring? Would you be willing to give it to your fiance as an engagement ring? Would you be willing to pass it down as a family heirloom? I would think, no, that's like the ring of Sauron, basically. It's like not something you could, I mean, it would be a moral failure to wear that ring around casually. That person is not coming to my birthday party, right? So sometimes the tarnishing of an object is actually deeply significant. There are a pair of psychologists, Rosin and Nemiroff, who think this is a type of magical thinking. Like you're imagining that evil is this spreadable substance that gets like a goop that spreads onto the material. I don't think that's right at all. I mean, my intuition that it is wrong to wear that ring is just as clear and vivid as my sense that it's wrong to do any obviously wrong thing, like, again, torture someone just for the fun of it. So, I take that. I think that's a very serious type of moral failure to be insufficiently alert to the ways that objects have been tarnished by their histories. I mean, someone who goes to Auschwitz, I mean, that's an example of tarnishing. You cannot take the bricks of Auschwitz and just build some other place. Right. You can't take the fertilizer that the Nazis made out of the ashes of their victims. It's like, hey, this fertilizer's going to waste. We could be growing some crops with this. You know, let's get practical. It's like, actually, no, we don't want to eat that food, even if it were safe. We don't want to use those people in that way. It's similar kind of thing. Someone who thought it would be okay to use Nazi fertilizer made from the remains of their victims in that way, I think would be guilty, again, of a moral failure. So it's a deeply serious category, that this tarnishing, a category of value.
I was reminded, as you were talking about that, as of an issue of The Atlantic that came out, I think, last year, where they were looking at kind of the differences between American ways of remembering and German ways of remembering in light of gross, you know, human rights violations. And the German way is very interesting. I mean, obviously, they have, of course, the actual sites you can go to. But one of the artists there in Germany did a project where he would place discs outside of the homes of Jewish people who are dispossessed. And so throughout all of Germany, there are these little discs. And initially, they tried to stop him, but then realized it was such a powerful project that they allowed it to continue. And so then I'm thinking of someone like Clint Smith, who goes to different places in America and looks at how they communicate the history of those places in relation to things like slavery. And some places have done that very intentionally and very thoughtfully, but a lot of places really don't. And it seems to me like what's going on there in both cases is, in the one, a success, and the other, a failure at recognizing the humanity and the dignity of the victims who were involved. So it's not just that the thing is a thing, but the thing was used to affect the person. And that's what makes it a travesty. I'm not going to use that because that knife because I respect the person who was killed by it. Right. So there's a kind of, I think, a dignity valuation there, I think, wrapped up in that. And I don't think that's magical thinking at all. I think that's ties very much to what you were talking about creational theology.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is. It does. It flows out of, you're right that it flows out of the attitude we ought to have towards the persons affected by those objects too. That's right. So I was pointing out the tarnishing that the knife gets by being used for evil by a deeply evil person. But you're pointing out another part of it, which is something about what we should feel about the victims also controls what we should feel about the knife that murdered them. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that segues, you know, into the relationship that you've been researching, which is its application in human rights here, and you know, the ways that our relationships, you know, just are with each other, and the way we describe that maybe in law, and the way we describe that philosophically, even just narrate how we narrate those things in our interactions. So, could you help make the connection for us then between this conversation evaluation and its bearing on human rights?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah, I'd love to talk about that. So, I mean, first I would just take a step back and say, if you're a Christian, don't you think that God has got to have something to do with human rights? Wouldn't it sort of surprise you if, like, we have these universal basic rights, but God has nothing to do with explaining why. It seems like a Christian should probably go into it thinking God has something to do with the story, and we just have to figure out the details as to what. So, but we should back up even further and just clarify, like, by human rights, what I mean is, like, people matter in a way that makes a claim upon how we treat them. That's all I mean. And I mean, every person. We have this, I think we feel this, it's just about the only thing held sacred by my friends on the left and my friends on the right of the political spectrum. I mean, think about a dispute over abortion. Is one group worried about the rights of the mother, one group worried about the rights of the unborn? A dispute over the border is going to be a concern about the rights of the sojourner and the versus the rights of the citizen. But it's human rights in either direction. I mean, if you go far enough to the right or to the left, human rights starts to not be such a priority. But my sane friends on the left and the right, they share a deep commitment to human rights, and they just disagree about how to adjudicate what seem like competing rights claims. So these are people who can't even agree on the weather these days, but they agree on the sacred value of human rights. And it's very important that we think all people have these rights. And to make that vivid, think about the headline from the Rolling Stone a couple years ago, woman in 14-year coma gives birth to a boy. It's not a Christmas miracle. She was raped by her nurse. But notice that she was stuck in that coma. So to explain why this is an outrage, and it is just obviously an outrage. I mean, there's just no doubt. It's so clear,
right,
that he not only did wrong, but he wronged her, right? He wronged her. She had a status that he failed to respect. And yet she has no fancy abilities. She can't think, create, she can't write sonnets or launch rockets or raise her children, et cetera, et cetera. She's probably stuck in that coma forever. So you can't, and this kind of points to the trouble about explaining rights. Rights need to be explained. I mean, if we matter in a way that makes this profound claim on each other, we don't just matter for no reason. Something's got to explain why. What's so special about us? Why is it that if you're hiking in the forest and you get lost and you have to kill your horse and eat him, that's very sad. If you're hiking in the forest and you get lost and you have to kill your friend and eat him, that's altogether a different kind of story. Surely something explains the difference there. But it can't be our fancy abilities to reason, to govern our lives, to create, because even people in whom those abilities are dramatically and irrevocably impaired still have that status that demands respect. So the question is, how can we explain rights in a way that includes those people? And it has been infamously difficult for the secularist to do that. And so I think that what Christians should really think about here is, can I explain human rights in a way that includes the severely impaired? Because that would mean there's a powerful reason for endorsing Christian theism. If you're a secularist who is deeply committed to human rights, as many of them are, they care deeply about rights. Well, I want to say, look, you should consider Christian theism, because within your own secular worldview, you can't explain this thing that you hold so dear. So I want to step back and just set the issue up there, and then we can talk about maybe details, like how should a Christian be thinking about rights? I'll just pause there, see if you guys want to add anything.
Well, a question that comes to mind, and I think you did a helpful job in framing it for us, is, but a question that comes up within that is, okay, so we have on the left and the right, there's a kind of what we might call a preferred human rights cause. Let's just say there's, you know, cause A on one side and cause B on the other. What are some ways we might account for that, you know, in seeing that preferred cause, there's not always as much charity to see on the other side, that they're also advancing a similar cause, or a cause, but maybe from a different angle? Is it a matter, like you described earlier, of there's a lot of causes, and we can't be animated by every cause, and we're just having to pick the one that we're going to approach, and it's just a matter of, you know, prudential reasoning of which one to prefer over the other? Or is it an indication perhaps that they're not advancing or being animated by those causes because of the human rights involved, or is there another reason why those are being pursued? How might you help parse that out? Because that seems like, you could just look across at your neighbor across the aisle and say, oh, we're doing this thing, we're just doing it differently, versus no, are you know, we're doing very different things here.
Right. Yeah. There is certainly a growing sense of, I have nothing in common with those people.
Right.
They're up to a very different moral project. In the abortion debate, that's often clear because when I say what I just said, sometimes my conservative friends they're actually reluctant to acknowledge that my liberal friends are up to a human rights project. They want to say, no, they're denying human rights.
It seems like both have used that line for the other at some point, that they're
Yes,
not
that's right.
actually, they don't actually care about human rights, because if they did, XYZ would follow from it. But both are making that same claim about the other. And so, is nobody about really human rights here, or is it just, or is it just that where there's a misapprehension of how the other one is pursuing that?
Yeah, I think the maybe what's going on here is like the various cognitive distortions that result from tribalized thinking. And the best guy on this is I think Jonathan Haidt, who I really think Jonathan Haidt is one of the
Yeah.
best social commentators around today. So I would probably end up appealing to some of the stuff he describes about the way that we get tribalized. In his book, The Righteous Mind, I think it's the subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided Over Politics and Religion. That maybe gets to this. There are things that happen once I. So I used to be in a psychology lab at NYU when I was a grad student that studied the cognitive effects of classifying someone as an out-group member. And it doesn't have to be like they have a different race, different political affiliation, different religion. It can be as trivial as I give you a red shirt. There's a bunch of people in red shirts, bunch of people in blue shirts. I say, you guys are on different teams. You'll see the effects, the cognitive effects, even with such trivial and sort of ephemeral group distinctions, and their effects like being less able to empathize with the person wearing the other color of shirt, being less able to recognize their face or remember their names, things like this. So even with trivial outgroup classifications, you get these kinds of cognitive distortions that reflect a preference for your in-group. I don't think there's anything wrong with preferring your in-group. We all have to do that. I'm quite partial to my family, to other people. I'm partial to my neighborhood, to other neighborhoods. I'm partial to my country, to other countries. These loyalties, in many ways, define us, and this is part of human existence, a good part. But obviously, human life has been marked by a history of brutality and violence and unjust discrimination on the basis of outgroup classification. So that's a tendency, obviously, we need to correct. But I think it does take it too far to say, for example, that we ought not be patriots even, or that we ought not to have local commitments and local attachments to the free associations that we've formed in the course of our lives.
No, there's a it goes beyond just a preference so often, and there's almost like a lore that develops. I was thinking as you were talking about that, it came to mind a memory of a school I taught at, where they divided the kids up for like a retreat into teams that were just given different colored t-shirts, you know. But by the end of the 3-day retreat, there was an elaborate narrative established by every team about the other teams, like, you know, you got to watch out for green team because green team is shady, you know. And it's
That's
like
right.
you've known each other for, you know, 40 hours at this
Right.
point, and yet, you know, you already have made these definitive kind of character
That's true.
assessments.
Yeah, that experiment has probably been tried just thousands of times the world over at American summer camps, right? Yeah.
It strikes me that to have those natural affinities is one thing. It seems like when those affinities are constructed on those stories of us versus them, that it not only again affects the out-group, but it does affect the in-group. Like it's a malformation of the community. So it's actually bad for my nation if I prefer it to other nations in a way that causes me to lash out violently against those nations or whatever group it is. Our community is not what it should be if this is the mentality that we have. So we're being catechized poorly. I mean, you could even think about this in terms of Anglicanism, right? It's like our version of Anglicanism should not be not those guys. It should be what we're about. And if it's just we're not those guys, then it's not going to be a very healthy, growing movement. It's going to be angry and it's going to be reactionary. And I'm probably preaching to the choir at this point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we don't want to be too grumpy about those guys, but at the same time, we don't want to lose sight of the virtue of loyalty and the fact
Exactly.
that treason is indeed a despicable crime.
Right.
And I do think some people, this is going to be the tendency on the left. These tendencies will track left and right. So the right will tend to overemphasize their tribal commitments to nation and state and neighborhood. You're not a Georgian. What are you doing here? You Californian. The left will tend to, they have a kind of inverse loyalty where they're loyal to everyone else around the world, but not their country. In fact, they despise their country. And all of this has been talked about by Jonathan Haidt, of course, to great effect. But they have like this inverted group loyalty. Whatever they're doing is better than what we're doing. So if we're talking about America versus Europe, what Europe is doing is enlightened and what America is doing is bad. If we're talking about the West versus the East, oh, what all of the West, including America and Europe, is doing is bad, and what they're doing is good, right? If we're talking about the West and the East industrialized countries, what we're doing is bad, and what the hunter-gatherers are doing is good. So whatever my group's a part of, I'm like against that thing. That seems like this weird thing on the left that I don't know how to explain.
The more I love humanity in general, the less I love people in particular.
Yes, yeah, right.
So, Brian, if to come back to our one of our initial starting questions about enchantment here, and to kind of draw it into an applicable way, again, and to Father West's point about how this meets, our experience in day-to-day life, I guess the question as it's forming in my head is, how do we become enchanted in the right way? And also, how do we become disenchanted that we may avoid that?
I guess that's the million-dollar question, right? Is because for me, the point is for these reflections to actually shape our Christian experience, and it's to but basically, my project is framed by the thought that there are riches of the Christian life that we routinely overlook, myself included. And so, I want to sit down and say, okay, we have this promise of abundant life, and I can think of some obvious ways in which that promise holds. Like I get to know God as a something like a friend and an ally. That's of course a source of richness. I get to be forgiven. These are all very good, but there might be some more subtle riches of the Christian life that we tend to overlook. I think this is one of them that can get overlooked or partially glimpsed, and it helps to make it explicit. So I mean, one thing to do is, here's an exercise. Sit before your favorite tree in your neighborhood or in your yard, or go to the beach or your favorite park. I mean, all of us, loving nature is probably not an optional good on the menu. Hiking is an optional good. Wanting to go backpacking or mountain climbing, even a day at the beach, just some people who don't like being exposed to the elements all day. That's all fine, but all of us need some kind of significant contact with nature. And there's now an emerging science of this. A great book to read is called The Nature Fix. The Nature Fix. And that's reviewing of this is journalistic work that's reviewing all this emerging data about the effects of time in nature on our emotions and our cognitions. Basically, nature makes you feel better and makes you think better. So the least surprising discovery next to the discovery that babies need their mom's love. So, but there's still lots of fascinating data about the mechanism of how exactly this works. Okay, so all of us do need serious contact with nature. And so for the Christian, as you're engaging with nature, however you like to do, sit by the pond and watch the ducks, let yourself think, here is something made by God. Here is something that belongs to God, this duck swimming on the pond. Here is something that even in this moment, God is sustaining. Go to a tree and press your hand to its trunk and let yourself think that right now God is sustaining this tree and being. As I touch it, in a sense, he is touching it. My hand is against it. His hand is beneath it, holding it over the abyss of non-being. It's a meeting place of our two wills. It's a shared locus of your attention, in a sense. I mean, God doesn't, I don't think, literally have attention, because attention is the mind strategy for managing limited resources. But still, that's just to say God is fully aware of everything. So even as I am fully aware of this tree, God is fully aware of it. And it's the shared locus of our awareness in that sense. And so I think the way, how does this affect your life? It's pretty simple. As you're engaging with nature, focus on some of those thoughts. Focus on the ways in which the natural objects you admire are related to God as their creator, sustainer, as the one who owns them, who values them even right now as you value them, who is aware of them as you're aware of them. You can think about the fact that some of these objects that are very old had spatiotemporal relations to Jesus Christ as he walked the earth. The oldest tree would have been, it was cut down like 50 years ago, so some geologists could count its tree rings. And if that's not a metaphor for the modern era, I don't know what is. Talk about knowledge that's not worth having for the price. But it would have been, you know, something like 5,000 years old now. The next one's like 50 years younger. Those are trees that were in the middle of their life when Jesus hung on the cross, right? It's like their roots shuddered when God died. And you can stand before those trees, or even great sequoias in California that are, you know, over 2,000 years old. And you can think, you were a sapling. Some of you were feeling the sun strike your face as the moon was shining on Jesus at night in the manger. And that's a remarkable thought. So I think, like, Christianity, a lot of the ways it shapes your experience is by the creedal content of the Christian story coming to bear on our emotional life and shaping our emotions. And I think that's one of the major projects of the Christian life, is to take these things we know and make them into things we feel, that shape our patterns of feeling in the deepest sense. We're not chasing after feelings like we're trying to cultivate a high or something. We're trying to form our emotions. That's part of what it is to form our character. And so I think this is one of those Christian truths, is these various relations between God and the world need to be meditated upon in a deliberate way as we are in nature, in order to cultivate those emotions and open up those patterns of wonder and awe in our own emotional lives. And this is, of course, very meaningful for us.
Seems like one of the ways that, you know, one of the vehicles with which Christians can do this and converse about this and create points of interacting around this experience of appreciating and encountering in the way that you described. And one thinks of course, you know, Julian of Norwich, right? And her, you know, iconic hazelnut that she, you know, held in her cell and said, you know, she could behold all of God's love in this, you know, because God created it, he sustains it, and he loves it. Right, just this tiny little hazelnut.
Is that in the Revelations?
That is, yeah.
Uh-huh. You'll have to tell me what book that's in. That sounds sure. That was not in my mind, but I'll have to. I mean, that's perfect. That's just exactly what I'm talking about.
No, it was kind of springing to mind when you were giving that formulation. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the practical sides of this that was also coming to mind is, and I know that you're a I know that you're a musician. Our mm-hmm. listeners now know that you're a musician, but it raises the question that along these lines, and drawing in again your earlier comment about beauty, the objectivity thereof, you know, should Christians be really intent about making beautiful art? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, drawing some of these threads together, they seem like they would meet on that, in that question. You know, how would you respond to that? Do Christians have an obligation to make beautiful art?
Christians who are making art, or all?
Yes. So Christians who are making art, should that art be excellent and beautiful?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, my grandpa who's farming in Nebraska or whatever is
I shouldn't drop what he's doing to be an artist. Yeah. But yeah, if you're about the project, again, if that's part of the buffet of goodness that you're sort of putting on your plate, you know, and you're going to utilize that as a practice, given the concerns you've raised here about enchantment mm-hmm. and everything else, should there be a real concern for the objective beauty of the art that's created? Mm-hmm.
So this is a very interesting question. I mean, one question is broader, which is like, to what extent should all Christians, artists and non-artists alike, be involved in creative projects and expressions of their creativity? Where that needs to be understood broadly to include how you raise your children. You know, that's an occasion for creativity. You need to often come up with novel forms of problem solving to raise children. You raise children out of a vision of human life and the kind of life that's worth having together. So as long as creativity is understood broadly enough, it becomes more plausible that all Christians should be involved in the exercise of their creativity. But I suppose I wouldn't want to cling to that too rigidly. Someone who just is not at all creative and who's more of a follower, because creativity has this novelty element built into it. I wouldn't want to say there's something wrong with how they're living. Okay, so but to what extent is should Christian artists be focused on beauty? Certainly Christian artists should be have all the more reason to make art well, because think about it, one of the things that acquires bestowed worth, that becomes valuable because of who made it, are your own talents and gifts and capacities. And that just gives you all the more reason, because you're thinking of them, for example, as a gift from God. Gifts are being given as a gift is one way an artifact gets bestowed worth, right? Because your capacities are gifts, that gives you all the more reason to use them well. So certainly a Christian who's making art will want to make good art. Now, a next question would be, so what is good art? Does art have to be beautiful to be good? Or can it be sort of like, there are different ways for art to fail in beauty, but still be interesting as art. Think about the cacophonous note in the symphony, or the 20th century sort of specialized in trying to prove that good art could be ugly.
Right.
Right. And I think that what are the results of that project? I think they took it too far. But they didn't have no point. There is a place for the art that holds up the sort of ruined part of the world, right? The problem with kitsch is that it holds up the palace without giving you the ruins of the palace. And so I think like kitsch just wants to make life seem really nice, and then the modern artist wants to make life seem really rotten. And the problem is to stop there. What the Christian artist is going to do is like show you the rottenness, but then show you how that rottenness gets overcome in the redemptive arc of things. So I don't think the Christian artist will want to leave it at just sort of wallowing in the slime of life. You want to show how God triumphs through the darkness, right? You want to lay bare the wound. You want to show how the wound is the door, even into your own human future. So I would say that would maybe be a general principle and a general thing that the Christian artist should be having in mind as they create. They won't want to, you know, many artists want to be profound by showing us the darkness. The Christian artist must, maybe not in every single work, but maybe in the pattern of his work overall, must not lose sight of the fact that it's not good enough to stop at the darkness. We have to show how the darkness shall not overcome it, right? Mm.
Well, Brian, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for leading us through and sharing your work with us. I think you've left all of us with a lot to think about. So I really appreciate you coming on with us today. One of our, in order to kind of wrap us up here, I'd like to transition to a segment that is regular to our podcast, and ask, what are you into lately? And so maybe I'll give you a minute to think about that. We'll go around the table here. So Father West, what are you into lately? And then we'll go to Dr. Ballard here.
Yeah, so I've been preparing for Holy Week, all the services that we're going to do, all the sermons that need to be preached. And so I was doing some research, because, you know, the Palm Sunday epistle reading is Philippians 2, the canonic hymn, which is just one of the most profound portions of all of Scripture, in my opinion. And so I got out a book that I read, I think, initially at Neshota House when I was doing my STM in a class on Paul and asceticism. But it's so good. And I was just reading the chapter on Philippians 2. It's called Inhabiting the Cruciform God, Kenosis, Justification, and Theosis in Paul's Narrative Soteriology. And it's by also a former guest of the show, Michael Gorman, who's a professor up here in Baltimore at St. Mary's Seminary and University. He's a Pauline expert. And he really centers Paul's whole theological project around the canonic hymn in Philippians 2. And makes a number of good and, I think, important observations about it, and then reframes our understanding of justification around it. So he's certainly not maybe in more reformed camps where justification is purely a legal pronouncement, but rather for Gorman, justification is participatory. It's kind of very much related to what we're talking about here. It's very much about becoming more human. And I think that there's something really, really gripping about that vision of Philippians 2 and Paul's work as a whole. And so I really, really appreciate the work. One thing that I love about it is, you know, Philippians 2, although he was in the form of God, Gorman says we should understand that as because he was in the form of God. he took on the form of a servant, that there's something about divinity that is cruciform, that is kind of this kenotic experience. It's an excellent book. It's short, but it's really, really dense and awesome. So that's what I'm into. What about you, Fahmy?
Well, I am into lately, I'm very much preparing for Holy Week as well. We also will be doing a parish lunch this next Sunday, featuring some Irish fare for St. Patrick's Day coming up. And it's given me the opportunity to kind of dust off some old recipe cards that have passed down to me through the family. And that's been a fun kind of revisit on some of those. A lot of them are kind of these like leaves of grass kind of artifacts where, you know, because my grandmother had a true disdain for writing everything down on her recipe cards and insisting that a good portion of it remain a kind of oral tradition that, you know, was never written down. And there's in fact some recipes from her that she bestowed and then said, you promise me forever that you will never write this down. You will never write this on anything. You will just tell someone and teach someone how to do it. And so there, it's been fun kind of revisiting some of those partial recipes that she wrote down. And it has this kind of, the kind of awe and mystere of a spell book, you know, that's kind of passed down these kind of partial things that you have to be initiated into and things like that. So it's been fun. This last week, as I've been thinking of what to cook for next Sunday, it's been fun kind of revisiting the memories of her and her her persona in the kitchen, which was a real presence there. So and was a commanding presence at that. So that's been mostly what I've been doing the last few days. So and what I've been into. Dr. Ballard, what are you into lately?
Okay, lately I've been reading The Lord of the Rings, rereading this, and I just finished
nice.
It. So last time I read it was maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago even. And boy, was it a joy to reread. And it's very interesting to see the things that sort of stick out to me this go through. One of them is this book is a long celebration of horses, like the role of horses in The Lord of the Rings. Like, and I'm someone who loves horses. I've been known to shed a tear or two when I happen upon a horse in the wild. And another thing that struck out to me was the ending is so poignant. There's like four chapters of like falling action in The Lord of the Rings, but it's to me, it's so meaningful. I want all of that falling action. So many goodbyes, so much, it's just deep closure brought to the story. I think that's alien to a lot of modern storytelling. They want to rush the closure a bit or not give it to you at all. Like that's edgy and cool or something. And I particularly was struck by something I would have missed as a childless man reading that book, which is that the ending of it is Sam pulling his little girl onto his lap. And so Sam journeyed to the cracks of doom to defeat Sauron, only so that he could come back to the Shire and live a good, ordinary life with his child on his knee. And that... there's all these beautiful moments where Frodo is telling him that he can't be torn in two forever. He's got to become whole again, because part of Sam's heart is in Rivendell, is with the adventure, the longing for the wild. And then part of his heart is with his family and with his hearth and his home. And I think that's a tension that all of us feel pulled between. When you're younger, on your great adventure, you long for the stability and the hearth. Then as you get older, you become tied down to your hearth and you long for the great adventure. And it's two beautiful parts of life that are that we yearn for, but that are difficult to combine. Talk about the menus. Some people will specialize more in that adventure, some more in the homemaking and the stability. But boy, I feel that I feel Sam's tension there for sure.
No, that's poignant and a perfect place, a perfect imaginative image for us to conclude on today. Dr. Ballard, thank you again. Listeners,
having me.
Yeah, no, listeners, this that brings us to our conclusion today. So please, by all means, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and like and subscribe on YouTube, and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. And as always, you're welcome to join the Communion of Patreon Saints for a mere $5 a month. Father Wes, would you give us your blessing on our way out today?
Absolutely. The peace of God, which passeth all understanding, keep your hearts and minds in the knowledge and love of God and of his Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. And the blessing of God Almighty, Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, amongst you, and remain with you always. Amen. Amen.
Thanks again.